This is an unfinished manuscript by Ivan Illich, entitled Needs. No matter where you travel, the landscape is recognizable. All over the world, it is cluttered with cooling towers and parking lots, agribusiness and megacities. But now that development ends, Earth was the wrong planet for this kind of building, growth projects rapidly turn into ruins, junk, among which we must learn to live. 20 years ago, the consequences of growth worship already appeared counterintuitive. Today, Time magazine publicizes them with apocalyptic cover stories. And no one knows how to live with these frightening new horsemen, many more than four, a changing climate, genetic depletion, pollution, the breakdown of various immunities, rising sea levels, annual wanderings of fugitives in the range of millions. To simply address these issues, one is caught in the impossible dilemma of fostering either panic or cynicism. But even more difficult than to survive with these environmental changes is the horror of living with the habits of needing, which four decades of development have established. The needs that the rain dance of development kindled not only justified the despoilation and poisoning of the earth, they also acted on an even deeper level. They transmogrified human nature. They reshaped the mind and senses of Homo sapiens into those of Homo miserabilis. Basic needs may be the most insidious legacy left behind by development. The transformation occurred over a couple of centuries. During this time, the root certainty was evolution, now called progress, now called development, now called growth. In this secular process, men claim to discover resources in culture and nature, in what had been their commons, and turn them into values. The historian of scarcity relates this story. Like whipped cream which suddenly hardens into butter, Homo miserabilis recently appeared, almost overnight, from a mutation of Homo economicus, the protagonist of scarcity. The post-World War II generation witnessed this change of state in human nature from common to needy man. Half of all individuals born on the earth as Homo are of the new kind. As a footnote, that the tie between the want and the commodity can be experienced. In this case, I speak of a perceived need that has been established through the creation of this tie. The tie between the subject and the commodity can be the result of an observer. I then speak of an imputed need and treat the so-called want as an imputed lack in the subject. If the imputation of a needs made according to the rules that are accepted by a profession, economists, biologists, social workers, psychologists, I speak of real needs, because I find that this is the term most frequently used in the literature. Archaeological estimates place the total number of adult individuals belonging to Homo sapiens at far less than 5 billion. They lived between the time the hunting scenes of Lascaux were painted and the year Picasso shocked the world with the horror of Guernica. They made up 10,000 generations and lived in thousands of different lifestyles, speaking innumerable distinct tongues. They were snowmen and cattle breeders, Romans and Mughals, sailors and nomads. Each mode of living framed the one human condition in a different way, around the hoe, the spindle, wood, bronze or iron tools, but in each instance, to be human meant communitary submission to the rule of necessity in this place at this time. Each culture translated this rule of necessity into a different idiom, and each view of necessity was expressed in a different way to bury the dead, a different ritual to exorcise fears. This enormous variety of cultures witnesses to the plasticity of desire and longing, which tasted differently in each. Fancy drove Tongans on their outriggers across thousands of miles of ocean. It drove Toltecs from Mexico to build temple outposts in Wisconsin, Muslims from Outer Mongolia to visit the Kaaba, and Scots the Holy Land. But in spite of all the forms of anguish and awe, terror and ecstasy, the unknown following death, nothing indicates that the ancestral half of humanity experienced anything of what we take for granted under the designation of need. The second and larger part of humanity was born in the epoch that I can remember, after Guernica, 1936. Most who are now adults are addicted to electric power, synthetic clothing, junk food, and travel. To trust osteopaleologists who rummage through cemeteries to study bones, the second half of humanity contains a large proportion who are malnourished and physically impaired, and most of these 5 billion unquestioningly accept their human condition as one of dependence on goods and services, a dependence which they call need. In just one generation, needy man, Homo miserabilis, has become the standard. The historical movement of the West, under the flag of evolution, progress, growth, development, discovered and then prescribed needs. In this process, we can observe a transition from man the bungling toiler to man the needy addict. In this essay, I trace the history of this addiction as it is reflected by the term needs. In the context of the official discourse on development since President Harry Truman. In an important sense, development is a rebellion, an obstinate refusal to accept necessity. It implies a simultaneous deconstruction of necessities and a reconstruction of desires into needs. In the development discourse, needs are neither desires nor necessities. Necessities call for submission. Needs call for satisfaction. Needs attempt to deny the necessity, to accept the unavoidable remoteness between wish and fact, nor do they refer to the hope that desire come true. People have always lived, faced by the necessity of dying if they lack their daily bread, and all peoples have felt the desire for glory, on earth or in heaven. Further, needs must be distinguished from wants, since Hobbes and Locke, these latter have been attributed to man and woman, creating Homo economicus, living under the aegis of scarcity, and the existence of wants seemed to be proved by demand. Mimetic desire brought forth the power of the market's hidden hand, pitting each against the other in pursuit of scarce goods. In one sense, needs are latter-day wants in the development discourse, as choices are offered, legitimated, and prescribed by professionals. They are then recast to fit into the mental construct of systems thinking. When this occurs, Homo economicus is rapidly recognized as an obsolete myth. The planet can no longer afford this wasteful luxury, and replaced by Homo systematicus. The needs of this latter creation metamorphose from economic wants into system requirements, these last determined by an exclusivist professional hegemony, brooking no deviation whatsoever. The fact that many people today already recognize their systemic requirements principally argues the power of professional prestige and pedagogy, and the final loss of personal autonomy. The process began with the losses of commons, and now appears complete, as people are turned into abstract elements of a mathematical stasis. The latest conceptualization of these abstract elements was recently reached through the reinterpretation of common man, now seen as a fragile and provisionally functioning immune system always on the brink of breakdown. The literature itself of this development accurately mirrors the esoteric character of this conceptualization. The condition of postmodern man and his universe has become so complex that only the most highly specialized experts can function as the priesthood capable of understanding and defining needs today. Thus, the human phenomenon is no longer defined by what we are, what we face, what we can take, what we dream, nor by the myth that we can produce ourselves out of scarcity but by the measure of what we lack, and therefore need. And this measure, determined by systems analysis thinking, implies a radically new perception of nature and law, and prescribes a politics more concerned with the provision of professionally defined requirements, needs, for survival, rather than with personal claims to freedom, which would foster autonomous coping. It is difficult to speak convincingly of the historicity of needs. We live in a generation which cannot deny the existence of human needs, least of all the needs of others, strangers. In the popular mind, human nature is perceived in terms of common needs, no longer in terms of a dignity shared by all, in spite of distinctions in status. In this context, a triple heart bypass is not seen as a foolish and wanton desire, nor as a demand which only the rich can claim, but as a need which translates into a right which, today, calls for an entitlement. For people generally, needs acquire their absolute legitimacy, paradoxically, when one is certain that they must be attributed to strangers, especially in those circumstances under which it is obvious to common sense that, for the majority of the needy, such needs cannot be met. Ironically, when human nature is socially defined by a bundle of needs basic to all, then a kind of scientific proof appears that for most members of the human family, what is basic is definitively beyond reach. To see how we reach this impasse, which now gives way to a systems analysis model, it is instructive to trace the stages through which the notion of needs was related to economic and social development in the last few decades. The idea of development entered Western political discourse through the inaugural address of Harry Truman in 1949. Truman sounded altogether credible when he advocated the need to intervene in foreign nations with industrial progress in order to raise the standard of living in the underdeveloped areas. He didn't mention revolution. His aim was to lighten the burden of the poor, and this could be accomplished by producing, quote, more food, more clothing, more materials for housing, and more mechanical power, unquote. He and his advisers saw, quote, greater production as the key to prosperity and peace, unquote. He spoke in terms of legitimate aspirations, not about needs. When Truman spoke, poverty, in terms of a market economy, was still the common lot of the overwhelming majority in the world. Surprisingly, a few nations appeared to have overcome this fate, thereby stimulating the desire in others to do the same. Truman's common sense led him to believe that a universal law of progress was applicable, not only to isolated individuals or groups, but also to humanity at large, through national economies. Thus, he used the term underdeveloped for collective social entities and spoke of the need to create an economic base capable of meeting the expectations which the modern world has aroused in people all over the planet. 12 years later, Americans heard that, quote, people in huts and in villages of half the globe struggle to break the bonds of mass misery. We pledge to help them to help themselves. We pledge this not because we seek their votes, but because it is the right thing, unquote. Thus spoke John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address in 1961. The statement symbolized an emerging consensus in the U.S. that most people are needy, these needs give them rights, these rights translate into entitlements for care, and therefore impose duties on the rich and powerful. According to Kennedy, these needs are not just economic in nature. The poor nations, quote, have recognized the need for an intensive program for self-help, a need for social progress, which is an indispensable condition for growth, not a substitute for economic development. Without social development, the great majority of the people remain in poverty, while the privileged few reap the benefits of rising abundance." Unquote. 1 year after Castro's rise to power, Kennedy promised more than economic or technical help. He solemnly pledged political intervention, help in a peaceful revolution of hope. Further, he went on to adopt fully the reigning conventional rhetoric of political economy. He had to agree with Khrushchev, who told him in Vienna, quote, "The continuing revolutionary process in various countries is the status quo, and anyone who tries to halt that process not only is altering the status quo, but is an aggressor." Unquote. So Kennedy then stressed the shocking and urgent conditions and the need for an alliance for social progress. For Truman, it was the modern world which arouses new aspirations, and he focused on the need to lighten the burden of their poverty. Kennedy believed that half the world lives in bonds of misery, with a sense of injustice, which breeds political and social unrest. In the perspective of the 1960s White House, poverty ceased to be faked. It had become an operational concept, the result of unjust social and economic conditions, lack of modern education, prevalence of inadequate and backward technology. Poverty was now viewed as a plague, something amenable to therapy, a problem to be solved. In 1962, the United Nations recognized poverty as a definable threshold, somehow related to what is human. The Secretary General referred to, quote, "those people who live below an acceptable minimum standard," unquote. And this standard soon revealed its complex nature. It acted just like an iatrogenic disease, that is, a disease made by doctors, spreading mayhem throughout the world. The sad results of policies conceived as therapies for this conceptualization of underdevelopment. Then, in 1972, the president of the World Bank declared progress that is measured by a single measuring rod, the GNP, has contributed significantly to exacerbate the inequalities of income distribution. And for this reason, McNamara declared that the central objective of development policies should be the attack on absolute poverty, which had spread as a result of economic growth, and which was so extreme that it degrades the life of individuals below minimal norms of human decency. Soon, these norms of human decency would be spelled out in dollars and cents by a team of social scientists who formed a kind of brain trust within McNamara's office. The confusion and, at times, opposition between economic and social development, observable in McNamara's thinking, between mere growth and true or human development, became a part of public rhetoric, of what I have termed the development discourse. Through efforts of experts to understand and establish the distinction, the term needs first acquired its vexing power, still current today. Using this term, the humanistic political theory of development sought anchorage within some ontological concept of human nature. In appearing to be empirically relevant today, this search worked its way through a new, a historical, notion of poverty. Until a few decades ago, poverty had been a synonym for the human condition. It was understood as a pervasive feature in the social landscape of every culture. Primarily, and above all, it referred to precarious conditions within which most people survived most of the time. Poverty was a general concept for a specific cultural interpretation of the necessity to live within very narrow limits, defined differently for each place and time. Each culture worked out its unique and ecologically sustainable style of coping with this necessity. as we can recognize today. This is what need formerly signified, the lifelong ability to face the ultimately unavoidable. We all need to die, however, not yet. Until recently, then, poverty never directly meant a lack. The necessity to accept fate, kismet, providence, the will of God, lost much of its legitimacy during the early 20th century. Progress reveals its face when it is understood basically as a revolt against necessity. Already in the epoch of steam, the engineer became the symbol of the liberator, a messiah who would lead humanity beyond the reign of necessity. By the end of the 19th century, society became the subject of manipulative engineering. The idea was so infectious that in the 20th century, a pope personally devoted to St. Francis of Assisi, the spouse of Lady Poverty, instructed his faithful on the duty to achieve more. According to the encyclical letter Progressio Populorum of Pope John Paul VI, individual nations must raise the level of the quantity and quality of production to give the life of all their citizens truly human dignity, and give assistance to the common development of the human race. The complete development of the individual must be joined with that of the human race, and must be accomplished by mutual effort. The relation of needs to the development discourse cannot possibly be understood without grasping how recently poverty was first operationalized, and then a poverty line could be defined as the frontier in a war on poverty itself. For Truman, poverty still represented a kind of common floor from which some rise through fortune, industry, or crime. By 1970, the attempts to analyze poverty bestowed on it the characteristics of an economic threshold, and this changed its nature for moderns. It became a measure of a lack in needed income. By defining the poor as those who lack income, which alone can satisfy their needs, that which income buys was surreptitiously reconceptualized as a commodity. Poverty in New York City, as well as in Ethiopia, became an abstract, universal measure of underconsumption. Those who survive in spite of indexed underconsumption were then perceived as victims of a double bind. They cannot fill their income lack through engaging in subsistence activities, and they are condemned to an existence viewed as inhuman and indecent. Economists began to explore the significance of this inelastic threshold. They recognized that it was not possible to speak of economic wants below an income level where demands have become substantially incommensurable. And as a footnote, the poverty line seems to have been coined by the chocolate-producing Quaker philanthropist and friend of Lloyd George, B.S. Rowntree, in 1901. Quote, "The recipients of charity are the poor, i.e. those who from causes primary or secondary are below the poverty line." The same expression was also used during the same year by Winston Churchill. Only in the 50s it was adopted for the construction of an indicator by the U.S. Department of Labor. The synonym poverty level has been adopted more recently. According to the NOED, it appears in the New York Times, February 2, 1976, page 13, it is said that 24.3 million Americans, more than 10% of the population, were classified as poor in 1974. From 23 million in 1971, the poverty level is defined by the Department of Labor. In 1978, the New York Times speaks about 1 million in West Germany living below the poverty level. People who live below the absolute poverty line have no power to behave according to economic rationality. They cannot afford to trade food against shelter or clothing or tools. The new category of economic cripples, thus defined, may in fact survive, but they do not fully participate in the characteristics of Homo economicus. They exist all over the world. but they are marginal, not just to the economy, but to humanity itself, since the latter, from the time of Mandeville, has been defined in terms of the ability to make choices under the assumption of scarcity. Under a different guise, people also entered the development discourse earlier. From a United Nations publication in 1962, while at the beginning of the 1950s the problem of developing countries was viewed essentially as a problem of productive wealth, by the end of that decade it became widely acknowledged that the crucial factor was not production, but rather the capacity to produce, which is inherent in people. At that time, then, quote, unquote. At that time, then, it became legitimate to speak about people as one of the ingredients of economic growth. It was no longer necessary to speak separately of economic and social development, since development, as distinct from growth, should automatically include both. Insufficiently qualified or capitalized people were increasingly mentioned as a burden or break on development. This third evolutionary step, which integrates the people factor into economic growth calculus, has a history of its own. In the mid-50s, influential economists had begun to argue that certain components of medical and educational services should not be understood as personal consumption, because they were necessary prerequisites of economic development. The great difference in the results of similar development policies at the same level of monetary income could not be explained without paying attention to the investments made in human beings. The quality and distribution of training, physical well-being, social discipline, and participation levels came to be called, quote, the residual factor, unquote. Independent of the amount of capital and labor available, economic development seemed to hinge on these social qualifications of people for jobs. During the 70s, two empirical observations qualified the concept of human capital developed in the 60s. On one hand, the assumption that the value of education or medical services is reflected in manpower qualification lost much of its credibility. On the other, the labor theory of value lost its meaning. Even in the weak terms in which it had entered mainstream economics, it became obvious that, irrespective of available manpower qualifications, the modernized sector could not be made sufficiently labor-intensive to provide enough jobs to justify the economically necessary redistribution of incomes in the form of earnings. No conceivable employment-oriented development strategy could create the work which would employ the lowest third or quarter of the population. As a result, planners during the 1980s transposed the development melody to a fourth key. Under various designations, they undertook the economic colonization of the informal sector. New stress was put on incentives for activities that would keep people busy in the black market, in the barter economy, or self-supporting in the traditional sector. Above all, shadow work became quantitatively more important, not just in fact, but also in policy. By shadow work, I mean that performance of unpaid activities that, in a market-intensive society, are necessary to transform purchased commodities into consumable goods. Finally, self-help activities, which in the 60s smacked of second best, became a favorable growth sector of planners and organizers during the 80s. This is the context within which the resuscitation of the discourse on needs must be interpreted. Development can be visualized as a process by which people are lifted out of their traditional cultural commons. In this transition, cultural bonds are dissolved, even though culture continues development in superficial ways. One need only observe rural people recently transplanted to the megacities of the Third World. Development can be imagined as a draft that blows people off their feet, out of their familiar space, places them on an artificial platform, a new structure of living. In order to survive on this exposed and raised foundation, people are compelled to achieve new minimum levels of consumption, for example, informal education, public health measures, frequency in the use of transportation, rental housing. The overall process, usually couched in the language of engineering, the creation of infrastructures, the building and coordination of systems, various growth stages, social escalators, even rural development, is discussed in this urban language. Under the heavy weight of the new structures, the cultural bedrock of poverty cannot remain intact. It cracks. People are forced to live on a fragile crust, below which something unprecedented and inhuman lurks. In traditional poverty, people could rely on finding a cultural hammock, and there was always the ground level to depend on, as a squatter or beggar. This side of the grave, no one could sink below ground. Hell was a real pit, but it was for those who had not shared with the poor in this life to be suffered after death. This no longer holds. Modernized dropouts are neither beggars nor bums. They are victimized by the needs attributed to them by some poverty pimp. They have fallen through the poverty line, and each passing year diminishes their chances of ever rising again above the line. Welfare is not a cultural hammock. It is an unprecedented mediation of scarce resources through agents who not only define what need is and certify where it exists, but also closely supervise its remedy, with or without the needy's approval. Insurance is not reliance on community support in case of disaster. Rather, it is one of the ultimate forms of political control in a society in which protection against future risks is valued higher than access to present satisfaction or joy. Needs, discussed as criteria for development strategies, clearly have nothing to do with either traditional necessities or desires, as I suggested above. Nevertheless, during the second and third development decades, poverty came to be defined in terms of unmet, operationalized needs. And all of this occurred in spite of the fact that for the mainstream economist, need is a non-word. Economic theory does not acknowledge that there are such things as needs. Further, economics cannot say much that is useful about desires, preferences, and demands. But need, presumably, is a moral, psychological, or physical imperative which brooks no compromise or adjustment, or economic analysis. Most economists, up to today, declare themselves incompetent to include needs in their analysis, and prefer to leave the needs discussion to philosophers or politicians. On the other hand, a growing number of economists critical of conventional development theory and practice found in basic needs the foundation for what came to be called the new economic order. They thought to find in needs the term for non-negotiable, mutually incommensurable requirements of human nature. These had to be provided for by the economy before economic preferences, choices, and wants could be effectively formulated. But before the concept of needs could be incorporated in economic argument, it had to be defined and classified. For this undertaking, Abraham Maslow's theory of a needs hierarchy suddenly became very influential. Indeed, physical, safety, affection, esteem, and ultimately self-realization needs underlay most current discussion as the key categories. Unlike wants, which, since Hobbes are considered as equal, since they're simply what people want, needs are consistently discussed as fitting into an objective hierarchy. They are generally spoken about as realities to be disinterestedly studied by needs experts, and which can, in some way, lead to the definition of a universal ethics. For example, Eric Fromm believes that the sane society is an arrangement that, quote, corresponds to the needs of man, not necessarily to what he feels to be his needs, because even the most pathological aims can be felt subjectively as that which the person wants most, but to what his needs are objectively, as they can be ascertained by the study of man, unquote. Up to now, the most complete critical study of the needs discourse and its implications has been made by Marianne Grönemeyer. More clearly than anyone else, she has demonstrated that needs, in the current sense, are a new way of formulating the assumption of universal scarcity. Further, she shows that needs, defined under the guise of science, permit the redefinition of human nature according to the convenience and interest of professionals who administer and serve them. Of particular interest is the role played by basic needs in the transformation of economic man into needy man, a process which coincides directly with the redefinition of poverty in recent development theory. Development is based on the belief that necessity can be cancelled by engineering audacity, literally utopian, nowhere. Development takes off beyond a minimal level of consumption determined by scientific insights into human nature. To share in a meaningful way in the benefits of this development, one must first consume a certain minimum amount of basic services, largely paid for by taxes and/or borrowing from future generations. One needs a prescribed amount of education, healthcare, news, transportation, protection, administration, in order to be human enough to share this new world. But, quoting from Marianne Grönemeyer's Die Macht der Bedürfnisse, Reflexionen über ein Phantom, The Power of Needs, Reflections on a Phantom, insistence on basic needs is inevitably double-edged. It implies that you can become either more or less human. Needs define humanity as divisible. Unquote. And, as another has also clearly seen, quoting Agnes Heller, The Theory of Needs in Marx, speaking about needs, she says, they define the individual and reduce it to the profile of its needs. Unquote. For Talcott Parsons, already in 1951, quote, personality is to be viewed as the establishment of a relatively specific, definite, and consistent need disposition. Unquote. As Michael Ignatieff has pointed out, no other age has had a term or idea which occupied that place in its constellation of meanings which now occurs in ours, which need now occupies in ours. Certainly needs are not the necessities of Adam Smith, who writes in Wealth of Nations, quote, required by the support of life, and in addition, whatever the custom of the country renders indecent for creditable people, even of the lowest order, to be without. Custom has rendered leather shoes necessary for life in England. The poorest creditable person of either sex would be ashamed to appear in public without them. In Scotland, custom has rendered them a necessity of life of the lowest order of men, but not to the same order of women, who may, without any discredit, walk about barefooted. In France, they are necessary neither to men nor to women. Unquote. This passage bespeaks a world in which, firstly, moral relations between strangers were modified by custom or culture, and secondly, status defined necessities, which precisely for these two reasons are not basic needs. Today, the attempt to insert moral sense in the development discourse must rescind customary we would say cultural, norms which Smith could take for granted. In anything approaching the character of moral statement, within the ever more radically amoral context of developed societies, must resort to a new kind of appeal not formulated according to custom. This situation brings out and partially legitimates the professional. He is uniquely positioned to know what strangers need, much better than the clients themselves. They are bound to be misled by the vestiges of their traditional cultural traits. Unquestioningly, the basic needs approach to development does provide criteria, truly new ones, for formulating institutional claims based on the imputed needs of the weakest, who, by definition, are those without the acquired ability to recognize their own misery as a result of their unmet needs. The metaphor or model for the modern needs expert is the physician. He, rather than the patient, knows what the latter needs because, more often than not, the disease is the result of the patient's own behavior. The principal task of the needs diagnostician coincides with that of the modern doctor. He must educate those he serves to accept his views and comply with his prescriptions. In the 1970s, participation and advocacy were still unsullied terms. Experts presented themselves as servants who helped the poor become conscious of their true needs, as a big brother to assist them in the formulation of their claims. This welfare dream of bleeding hearts and blue-eyed do-gooders can today be easily dismissed as the nonsense of an age already past. Needs in a vastly more interdependent, complex, polluted and crowded world can no longer be identified and quantified except through intense teamwork scrutiny of system specialists. And in this new world, the needs discourse becomes the preeminent device to reduce people into individual units with input requirements. We are at a threshold of a still unnoticed transformation from a political consciousness based on progress, growth, and development, rooted in the dreams of the Enlightenment, to a new, yet unnamed consciousness, defined by controls which ensure a sustainable system of need satisfaction. Development is dead, yes, but the experts who gave us needs are now busily at work reconceptualizing their gift to us, redefining humanity yet again. To survive, they say, we must now see ourselves not as citizens but as cyborgs in the image of immune systems, infinitesimally small units in a series of inclusive systems ending no one knows where. The all-important factor is best understood not as need but as requirement. The complex of requirements for each system, if this view comes to prevail, then men and women will indeed cease to be. Some years ago, the promoters of development promised more, thus creating the psychic condition for the implantation of needs, which led to the creation of a needy addict, a being in whom we all share. Perhaps the new systems experts can be outwitted through the moral courage necessary to kick bad habits.